interview on 1 June 1971 with Otto Czerny.
You're recording right now. We're live.
All right. Is this the right distance now of the microphone?
About right, yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
May I make a correction first? My name is Otto F. Czerny, and F stands for France.
So you pronounce it with a C. It's all C. I keep forgetting that.
C, yes.
Why do
with
I say
C?
I know it's Czerny.
I make a pause now. The real pronunciation in Vienna is Czerny.
Czerny.
Of course, here I prefer Czerny because it's better understandable.
Okay.
I do have two nicknames. One is Franzl, which is a miniaturizing of France, and it is used in a tender way. The second nickname is Otto Bald.
That's a nickname.
No?
You think of Billy Bald.
My real name is, like Billy Bald, but in my case it has a different meaning because Bald means soon in German. And since I never was there soon, they called me Otto Bald. Okay. Now, to know how I came into the rocket business.
Right.
Well,
During
my study at the Technical University of Vienna, I always had the desire to be active in aviation. And later on, the desire was extended to be also active in rocketry.
How did that start? I'll interrupt once in a while. Did you know about any of the rocket experiments made in Austria?
Yes, I heard and read about Sanger's experiments and about Opel's experiments, and I was intrigued by these people who tried to use this rocket propulsion as a means to achieve great velocities and also as a means to fly, to achieve a propulsion system for aircraft which was much superior compared to the customary propeller. So when I finished my study in December 1936, I tried first to get some job in Austria, which was not possible at this time. It was a bad situation in Austria. So I rode out to Germany and got three offers, and one of them was from Focke Wulf in Bremen. And Focke Wulf. Focke Wulf was later on known for the design and the production of the Focke Wulf Weihe, which was a trainer airplane, and then of the Focke Wulf 200, which was used as a exploratory airplane, a reconnaissance airplane, and particularly later on of the FW-190, which was a very good fighter plane in competition with the Messerschmitt 109. This continues to run.
Well,
I have to push once more.
Yeah, that's all right, and I'll really. This is really my fault.
Okay. I worked from 1937 to 1938 at Focke Wulf on the aircraft design, aerodynamics, hydraulics, and center of gravity determinations, etc. I met people from the DVL, Deutsche Versuchsanstalt für Luftfahrt, and they told me about the Flugbauführer career. Flugbauführer means aircraft builder, leader in the literal translation, and they were created because there was a need to have engineers who simultaneously were pilots. At this time in Germany, they had engineers and they had pilots, and they wanted to have a combination of both. And this career included, encompassed a 3 years education in industry, and also it was connected with pilot training. Basic requirements was a master degree in engineering, and of course full health and full flight worthiness or flight capability of the candidate. And I passed his pre-examinations and became a member of the Flugbauführer team. At this time in Germany, only about 130 or 140 Flugbauführer were in the process of being educated. Some of the top people had already finished and were the chief pilots of Messerschmitt, Focke-Wulf, Blumenfors, and others. And, of course, this was a very intriguing career, and it was 1938. And I liked it very much because my first assignment was Daimler-Benz, where I had to work on the famous DB601 fighter aircraft engine and DB606, which was later on used in the Heinkel 177. I designed several improvements, particularly for fighter utilization and excess of the normal performance of the engine, and and received a call for pilot training in 1939, in early 1939, went to Braunschweig, where I got my pilot training until the war started in the 1st of December, 1939. And I was then sent to Rechlin, which was also an Air Force proving ground, where I was introduced, I got an introduction to airplane and air engine testing, flight testing. And later on, in continuation of this education, I was assigned to the Air Fleet Command number 5, which had a seat in Vienna. At this time, we had still the choice to select where we wanted to serve, and I selected, of course, Air Fleet Command number 5, because it was in Vienna, and Vienna is my hometown. So we had a very interesting mission there. We were three master degree engineers, Flugbaufuhrer engineers, who had to evaluate the Poland campaign and investigate statistically the losses of the aircraft and also make proposals for improvement. And we made a proposal for armoring of the, particularly of the pilot seat, because many losses in the Polenfeld campaign were caused by injury of the pilot. And later on, this armor in the airplanes, of course, was further developed and used in all kinds of airplanes. We had a discussion with our boss, General Engineer Dr. Weidinger, in spring 1940, and he closed the door and said, "It's very top secret, but there is a call to Peniman, they need engineers." And we asked it, "For what is this?" He locked again the doors and said, "It's rocket."
Who was
Dr.
Weidinger?
Dr. Weidinger. So we got an assignment to Peenemünde. They've flown up there, and from May 1940 till May 1945, I served in Peenemünde as a test engineer. And okay.
Well, who did you meet? Let me interrupt a little bit. Who did you have to use that cutoff? I don't care if we lose a little bit of space.
Okay.
It's not working too well.
Right.
Who did you first contact at Peenemünde? Who were your first people? Who did you interview, for example?
Yeah, I was interviewed by Mr. Weigand, who was then my boss.
It's the same Weigand who is in the Pentagon.
He was the boss of the propulsion department in Peenemünde West, which was the Air Force proving ground of Peenemünde. And I served in his department as first as project and engineer, and then later on as group leader, and had responsibility for project assignments for all kind of rocket utilization. We tested rockets which were developed from the industry, but we also contributed to the development by introducing our own ideas and even in certain cases developing our own rocket propulsion systems and testing them. So I was involved in flight testing as well as flying as a test engineer, as an observer and test engineer, when big airplanes were needed to test some glide bombs, for instance, which I was assigned with, to take care of the propulsion system, with the propulsion system of the airborne. We had also some...
What are the designations of these glide bombs? Were the H-Central type?
Yes, yes. See, the first thing in Peenemünde was quite interesting. I made the acquaintance of several very close cooperators, Dr. von Braun and this himself. Then in 1940, the army proving grounds in Peenemünde, whose boss was Dr. von Braun and Dr. Dorenberg, tried to develop a jet assistance take off with liquid oxygen and alcohol as fuel, and kerosene alcohol as fuel.
This was for Heinkel 111, wasn't it?
This was for Heinkel 111 and was also intended to be used for other heavy loaded planes. And I was sent over there to attend the development of the captain's test of his rockets. And there was a very nice episode. I remember Mr. Riedel III, he's one of the famous rocketeers, who's dead now, came and he said, well, you always have these burn holes in the nostril, in the throat of the nostril, and I'll tell you what to do. And he took a piece of plastic out of his raincoat. He also wore a big raincoat, and he said, just use this. And he put his band-aid, it was a band-aid as a matter of fact, and put it in the throat of the nostril, and from then on we didn't have any burn throughs anymore. Of course, this was improved later on. The NASA alloy was used, and maybe the nostril was changed a little bit. So this extra thing has that because of the oxygen utilization, the army, the Air Force, the aviators, they're not accepted by the Air Force because the liquid oxygen was difficult to maintain, and they evaporated too fast, and for logistics and so on, it was not too good. While Walter developed another J2 rocket, which had an oxidizer H2O2. Yeah, Dr. Walter, yeah.
Yeah, another time I'd like to show you these things. That's why I don't know what you were primarily interested in.
Yes.
Some of the day I'd like to come down to my document and photo file.
Yeah.
And all about the things I'm going to see them on the developments for JETO, pictures and so forth. And also the all of Walter.
I would like to see this. It could be very, very interesting. Well, anyhow, Walter developed it, and we tested it, and it turned out that because of the hydrogen peroxide, and the fuel which was used, it was better to maintain, better to supply, and better to store. So these Walter rockets were victorious in the competition and were accepted by the Air Force. And one of the next assignments in fall 1940 was to go to Paris, where these Walter rockets were used in the preparation or in the performance of the Blitz against Great Britain, because all the runways in France were too short, and so they used these two rockets in order to get these heavy loaded Heinkel 111s and all the Blumenfoss water hydroplanes from the water in this case. They were very successfully used. Some technical soldier units whom I instructed, and I tried to show them when they had to do some repair, and when they had any difficulties, I helped them and advised them. I stayed in France from 1940 till...
Fall 1940.
I didn't mention this here in this list because it just was an in-between assignment. I was there from about, I believe, October 1940 till April 1941. Mm-hmm. And had also to dismantle one of the France installations. It was a wind tunnel, which we brought to Peenemünde, a barge, and later on couldn't use because the war made a turn to the verse, and so we didn't have any time anymore. But anyhow, it was a very interesting time in France. I used my French language knowledge, which I acquired during the high school period, 7 years of French, but I learned in this, let's say, three-quarter of a year, more French than I had learned in high school. And I returned to Peenemünde and continued the development of rockets for all kinds of purposes, from, as I already said, from ground to air, and from air to ground, but also from air to air, and from ground to ground later on. So one example of the continued use of the JTOWS was the development in solid propellants. We used the Rheinmetall rockets, which were used for Messerschmitt 163, for Messerschmitt 262, and for Arado 234.
The Arado 234, was that just a prototype?
Yeah, I believe it was only produced as prototypes and never became a big, went into mass production. But these solid Rheinmetall rockets, R1502, I have this all here, R1503, had 500 and 1,500 kilograms thrust, and had the famous Dornberger drill. Okay. The bore through the solid grain, so the cylinder-shaped solid grain of these rockets, served the purpose that the rockets burned on the outer surface of the cylinder as well as on the inner surface of the cylinder, which created a almost equal burning surface, because the outer surface became smaller, the inner surface increased, and the surface, the thrust was, and the chamber pressure was proportional, of course, to the burning surface of the grain, because the burning surface produced the gases which caused the pressure. And this was tremendous helpful invention, which was called after Dr. Dornberger. He reportedly has invented this and initiated this, and we got some very constant thrust over the burning period. So the thrust only decayed in the very last fractions of a second. So this was one of the utilization of the solid. We also had the Henschel 298, which was an air-to-air missile, which was used for fighters, against fighters or against bombers.
They used that down at Schweinfurt, didn't they?
They used it at Schweinfurt, yes, and they used also, but the HS-298 was wire-guided.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be guided by wire, and it also could be ignited through the wire. While at Schweinfurt, they had some unguided rockets also, a lot of them.
Okay, but R-4, what were they called?
At Schweinfurt, they tried almost everything what they had.
They had the R-4 something series.
And another very interesting development from ground to air was the Henschel HS-117, the Schmetterling, the butterfly.
The Schmetterling, yes. We've got a lot of reports on the Schmetterling.
It climbed.
All of these pictures were later.
Good. Very good.
You'll say, okay, how it worked, and then I'll build up captions from that, because it's much better. I have a lot of pictures.
Now you have to tell me whatever
Let me ask you a few more questions on the V-1. Okay. Is this really the first go-around to establish more of what you worked on? Then at a later time, when we get all our notations ready, we'll come down to you with some specific questions.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't know you worked on NIDA. Now I know, you see.
Yeah.
And so on. I would like to ask you one question on the V-1, however, as far as the piloted version of this. This was made and flown by Hanna Reich, I understand.
Was flown by Hanna Reich.
Solely for the purpose of determining, or at least the announced purpose, was to determine what you had some control problems.
Oh, yes, but...
Was there ever a suicide version of this?
The behind purpose was to make it flight worthy and try that it can be flown by a human being.
Was this a suicide, or would the pilot eject?
The pilot had a chance to eject.
To eject.
Yeah, but it was
over the target?
Just prior to impact on the target.
Well, then he
ejected the on the water. On the water. See, he had a lifesaver vest, a swimming vest, and he had you had, for instance, it was not too bad as it sounds, because those targets were not intended to be far out on the ocean, but probably more close to, in the case of invasion, you know. So if that takes place in the English Channel, I mean, many fighter pilots from both sides have been rescued from the Channel.
Were you involved in the piloted version at all?
I was not involved in the piloted version. I was in the V1 only involved in the starting mechanism, and we used a solid Rheinmetall propulsion system for this purpose first. Later on it was changed to a Walter H2O2 development, and it was much more simplified, was much better, and was used in for operations.
Did you never involved in the launching? Who is the key man we would talk to about the operational use of the V1 that you could?
I would say you should talk to Willy Fiedler, and you should talk necessarily to Hermann Kröger, to Ivan Kröger. Ivan Kröger can tell you in details. They also had, of course, this utilization for hanging the V1 on Hankel's 111 and just launching them from the airplane against London.
Was that ever used?
Yeah, it was used, yes, certainly. Used. Certainly it was used.
It was launched, drop launch.
Drop launch, yeah. Used it as a guide bomb. It was done, yeah. And it was tested in Peenemünde.
And that was the V1 was your last assignment?
No. We were continuously working on the development on this Henschel 298, on the Henschel 117, almost until the very end. And one of the very interesting projects was the ground-to-ground project.
Which was that?
It was the X-4.
Was that wire-guided
It was a wire-guided anything type. And it was solid propelled. It was a very nice little gadget. And the wire problem, of course, to be spun off with this tremendous speed, this was a big problem. The wires, the spools had to be wound up in a certain way, and also the propellant, the rocket itself, was not too big a problem. It was a front burner, as we call it. It was a very small thing. It had only maybe a diameter of 4 inches or so, and a longitudinal length of maybe 7 inches, and it burnt on the front section of the cylinder only. For that purpose, it had to be insulated completely on the outer surface of the cylinder, because if it would burn over on the outer surface, the pressure would be too high and it would explode. And that was achieved by using a certain fire consistent lacquer, which was painted on the outside. And as a matter of fact, we tested this, and we had very nice successes with it. We had a little launcher, a little catapult from where it was launched, and the man who guided this had a little lever arm. He guided it on site to the target, and it had a magnesium light on the rear end.
It tracked the light.
And it tracked the light and directed it into the target. You could hit, of course, in clear weather, provided clear weather, you could hit for a distance of maybe 1 mile or so when you were on a hill or so, or maybe even further on. And we intended to use this against the Russian tanks, because the situation, of course, we didn't think we could win the war anymore. But the situation was very bad, because of the breakdown of the East Front. Soldiers and civilians flooded on the streets coming from the east, and Peenemünde is, as a matter of fact, part of eastern part of Germany today, now behind the Iron Curtain. And we know the misery of these people, and we had reports that the Russians, of course, they used all kinds of means, tanks and low-flying airplanes, to butcher on these highways. The highways were full with people and soldiers, and so they had an easy play. So we tried to use these X-4 against Russian tanks.
What was this? Any luck on that?
Pardon me?
Did you have any luck?
No, we didn't have any luck. We were ready to do so. I was only in Peenemünde with a few people. The main major person had already left for a place close to Hamburg at the North Sea where they were supposed to continue testing. We were there still, and we tried to, from some trucks, to use this X-4 against Russian tanks. There was a depot with warheads in Neubrandenburg, and unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know what to say, this depot was taken by the Russians. The Russians pushed forward and took this depot where we had all our warheads. So since this was conquered by the Russians, it was impossible to use the X-4 anymore. We didn't have any warheads. We only had testing equipment there, but the operational units and the warheads, in, most important of all, they were taken by these Russians units, which achieved this fast progress. So we couldn't do it anymore, and I had to stay in Travemünde. In the last days of the war, I was flying to Travemünde in order to get this specific lacquer from Hamburg. And I happened to be lucky. I was flying to Travemünde, which was the proving ground for the hydroplanes, for the German hydroplanes, Travemünde in Schleswig-Holstein. And from there, I got a car from the commander there and traveled to Hamburg. And Hamburg was flat at this time. And everything was gravel, I mean rubbish and so on. And this, this soldier who was my chauffeur, he knew Hamburg very well. He found through, and all of a sudden we stood at a pile of rubble, and there was a little blue light down there, and he said, "Here we are." And I said, "I couldn't believe it." He said, "Yes, you go down there." And then he had a little push button, and somebody opened up, and there was a light sluice, you know, that no light can come out. So it was still dark. We were let in. We had, of course, we had to show our identification. So we were let in, and then the second door opened. There was a bright light, and there were hundreds of people underground, under the rubbish, working. And this was about 4 days before the war ended. And I got exactly the lacquer. Had a specification, a number, a lot number. I got exactly a barrel of this lacquer which I needed for the utilization of the X-4 in Peenemünde. And I got it with the barrel. We traveled back to Travemünde, and I wanted to fly back, and I was the one who had the last telephone call with Peenemünde West. And Major Horweg, who was still there, told me, "Otto, do not come back. The Russians are already besieging us, and they're shooting at us with artillery from the mainland." So we jump into the boats, and we join in Travemünde, and we make this X-4 experiment then on the Elbe-Trave Canal. "Wait for me there." And I said, "Well, if you say so, I'll wait for you there." And of course he came. We met there, but of course then the war was over. And
right up to the last minute you were working.
I was trying to do something about it, and not really exactly with a hope to win the war, but just to ease the situation up and make it a little bit better for those poor people who were butchered by the thousands. Mm. So that was then the end of the war. I might tell you, if you want me, a little bit about Paris and my mission in Paris during this, a little bit more about this. I was in Paris assigned, as I already mentioned, from 1940 till spring 1941, and I had there an airplane. I had two cars, one driver and one secretary, and we traveled all over And that was the place where I met Lily's father, you know. Where I knew of his existence already. He was with a military group who was supposed to take care of this jet takeoffs, and I was still commanded by our commander, Mr. Powell from Peenemünde, from the development side, because this whole thing was barely finished in the development and was already operational. So there were still some few things to iron out, and so that's why they sent me over there. And I traveled from airport to airport and did what I could, and we had also very nice evenings once in a while. And they said, of course, now Jeremy is in Paris, now he will be a guide, he will be our tour guide. And so they came, and there was one, what do you call it, petty officer, the man who pays cash and all, administrators and so on. This guy, he was the first time in Paris, and he was married, of course, and he came with the Junkers, 52, and he left, of course, with his wife and had a very nice goodbye and so on. And when he wanted to descend from the Junkers 52, he lost his wedding ring. He got stuck somewhere, and so the wedding ring was lost, and he didn't dare to come back, of course, without the wedding ring. So he was crawling around about 5 or 6 or 7 hours in the Junkers 52 to find the wedding, which was given, and he missed the whole evening and the whole night, of course. And the next day was the following day, he had to go back again, so it was... I believe he found it there finally, but he was so disturbed.
Let me ask one last question, yeah. Otto. Yeah. Where did you go right after the war? I'd like to wind it up at that moment.
Yeah?
Tonight.
Okay. After the war, I was...
Where were you come in contact with the troops? Who were you captured by, so to speak? What zone were you in?
I was in the zone which was occupied by British troops. It was in Schleswig-Holstein, close to Lübeck. And as a matter of fact, I stayed for a few months then on Ivan Kroger's father's farm, yes, and helped there, and his wife was there, and his sister was there, and little Mike Kroger was 3 years old at this time. So we had on this farm, we just went through all this aftermath of the war. And after this, after a few weeks, they tried to convince me to go to Kiel, where most of our people from Peenemünde West were assembled in a camp. And the commander sent a messenger and said, why don't you come and so on? The British will give you a position. But I was not in the mood, number one. I didn't want to throw away this and take up another one. Number two, I had my parents in Austria, and my parents were aged about 70 and almost 80 years old, and they were in the Russian zone, as I found out. So I wanted to go back as fast as possible. So I left Schleswig-Holstein in August and traveled back by all kind of transportations to Austria. As a language instructor on a American food supply train. The crew took me with them because they wanted to know how to approach a German girl. They had no fraternization. There was fraternization was forbidden. So to approach a German girl in a decent way, they used impossible expressions. And in Germany, as they had founded up probably some prostitutes. And they asked me whether they could use it, and I said we had to start from the scratch.
And you don't see this on your resume, this particular.
No. So, it's not on the resume. So.
We're recording on the 4th of June, 1971. 4th of June, 1971. If you would say your name and your position, primary position during the as you want,
the full name. Ernst Klaus. At that time I was
the
group leader of the design
group for Wasserfall valves and related equipment. Do I have to press or
no? I think we can try. How did you first become associated with the rocket program at St. Amundi?
That was back to 79.
That's all right. I want to ask a few background questions. What was your first approach? How did you get, were you interested in it before that, or was it all come by accident? Or did you get a card in the mail and said that you're going to work at St. Amundi?
One day in 1938, my daddy gave me an advertisement from the Berliner Morgenpost. They say they are looking for designers in army place in Fürpommern. And you have to translate it later. And I became interested and wrote them. I got received an answer, and finally, one day in 1st of March 1939, I started to work as a designer in Finland.
You answered an absolute. Did you know what you were going to be doing then?
Hell no. I even heard from my former boss that he only would make some drafts for weather t-shirts and things like that. Nobody had any idea what it was.
Did you have any particular interest, or had you heard about
heard about rocketry. I didn't know that that Pinamina was a place.
No. Did you have any particular interest in that subject?
Oh, I had. Yeah. I mean, after I found out, I was...
Not before.
And thought to better myself. Mm-hmm. And then I arrived in Pinamina, I found people that I was before when I was an apprentice. Mm-hmm. I met them there again, and of course we were one happy family. I mean, at that time, Pinamina was a very, very small...
How small? What was the size of
it? We had about, at that time, 15 or 20 people in the design office. Mm-hmm. So we were small.
You were just what they call a regular design office?
Design office, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I met there at least 4 or 5 people I know from my apprenticeship time.
Mm-hmm.
Means I met Mr. Tessman,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Ludwig,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Pat, some other people. Mm-hmm. I met them again in Pinamina, and of course we were one happy family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, then you got you went into the design organization.
Design.
You were there.
Papa Riedel was my boss. Mm-hmm.
That's Riedel. Which one?
Riedel. He was my boss, and we worked hard, and had no complaints.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good in the 39. What did you primarily work on?
Design of valves.
At that time, on
A5 valve.
A5. Mm-hmm.
And later on A4 valve. Yes. Of course, at that time, I talked before about in 43, I was working on Wasserfall,
mm-hmm.
waterfall valve. And there I was the designer and the chief of the design group and in charge of the testing of those valves.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What was a living like for you, for a regular engineer working?
Living in general. First, we lived in Tenerife, and I arrived there. Mm-hmm. My family came. I was married, and we had one son at that time. Mm-hmm. And we lived in Tenerife in one of the normal resort quarters. That means running water along the wall. It wasn't too much.
Mm-hmm.
But from there on, we went to Pinamina. That means to the settlement there, to the Siedlung. And got there. House, and here we lived together just before the bombardment of Pinamina. My wife went away from Pinamina just 3 days before the bombardment, so we were not caught in the bombardment. I brought her to Eastern Prussia at that time, where her parents lived. When I came back, I found out that Pinamina was bombarded, and the only thing that I could do was try to get the rest of my furniture into a van.
Was your house hit?
It was hit somehow. I mean, some of my furniture was damaged. However, most of it was still in a good condition. so I could move it to Istanbul.
So you left your wife in an Eastern culture?
And I did, and I came back to Pinamina, and at that time, when he left, Pinamina was in Bombardment.
Was there a free movement of all the societies?
Anywhere at vacation time? Any place.
But you could never talk about what you were doing.
I never did.
No, because I mean, one was given very strict instructions, not
very strict instructions, but one wouldn't do that during wartime to betray anything.
No, I didn't mean consciously betray, but
no.
A friend of yours,
no.
Said, what are you doing? You couldn't tell
me. No, I wouldn't have said it.
Okay, so you came back after the bombardment.
After the bombardment, came back, put my furniture in a van, and shortly after I moved my furniture, the whole outfit moved to Anklam.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about.
Anklam.
Stop here.
What was your laboratory called?
After the British air raid in August 1943, the entire valve of laboratory moved to the, what is that town?
Anklam
in Pomerania, where they established a new facility. This is part what? Go ahead, one, two, three.
On the airport in Anklam.
Airport, and this is part of the overall plan to disperse activities away from...
Okay, number one.
Fourth plan. They moved the supersonic tunnel down. They moved production to Nordhausen area.
Yes.
Yeah, and so on.
Yeah. They did that already before.
But it was accelerated, wasn't it?
It was accelerated. The production was accelerated.
Right. Yeah. And they canceled all production, I guess, between the Monday, and they also canceled testing, didn't they?
Not one day. I mean, they continued
everything,
but
we're talking about travel from Anklam to Vienna.
And I came back from Vienna. I boarded the train in Berlin to go back to Kleinemünde, and I was traveling already the whole day before that. So I was standing up in a train in the suddenly I found myself on the floor in the train. I fell asleep, and of course I woke up after I hit the floor. That showed only how much we traveled and how little accommodation we could get at that time. That means no sleeping in a car or something like that.
Well, during the latter part of the war, you still had to maintain contact with all your contractors.
Sure, we had.
Didn't it feel very difficult with incessant bombing?
Yeah, I mean, we had in the valve area, we had people we called Hüttenbegleiter. That means people who just took care for one valve, one man for one valve. Finally, the American and the English found out that we were at Anklam on the Fliegerhorst, and one day we got a nice bombardment.
Do you remember? Can you tell us a little bit about that bombardment?
Oh, sure.
Was it a daylight or night bombardment?
It was a daylight. The day before, we had a nice party going, and the night before, we had a nice party going, and we were all a little bit groggy. And finally, the alarm sounded, and we just went out of the Fliegerhorst, and I took cover about half a mile away from the Fliegerhorst, and I saw some 27 bombers coming right in my direction. But you know always it is so if you think you are the target, they all come to you. And then they, I don't know how many bombs they throw, but everything was burning, and the all the buildings were destroyed or burning. So I went back after the bombers were gone, and I just threw out of my burning barrack the last item I still had. That was the end of our stay in Anklam.
Did they completely destroy us?
No, they did not completely destroy the facility. Only in our hangar, we had a lot of time bombs, and some machinery, lasers and so on, were damaged, but we managed to go in right after the bombardment, and with the help of some Air Force people, we defused some of the time bombs. And still during the time that we tried to get our equipment out, bombs were going up all around us. I mean, not direct in our vicinity, but still close by. So we put our stuff on trailers and the truck and started to move again. There was an aircraft company. The name of the aircraft manufacturer was Arado. They built only parts for airplanes.
Okay.
This company would have hit the first daylight bombardment of American bombers very much, and the partly destroyed.
In any event, the destruction or the damage to your operation forced you to move again. Where did you move to next?
We moved to... 3 days after the bombardment of Anklam, we moved to a new location, to Friedland in Mecklenburg. It took us quite an effort to get the facility approved by the Gauleiter of Mecklenburg. Mr. Greener from the Amateur Laboratory and myself, we went to the Gauleiter in Schwerin. In Mecklenburg to get the permission to move our equipment into an empty grain hangar in Friedland, Mecklenburg.
How did you make the decision to try to go there?
The decision to go there was only dictated to us for the fact that was the only big room in the whole area still available. All the other places were bombed or out of commission.
Now why didn't the Dalai?
He probably was afraid that since he was there with the army, that he would take away too much from his glory, and he didn't like that at all, I guess. Really important, yeah.
So
we went to Friedland and established our laboratory in an empty grain hangar. There's a mile there running around on the floor, and one day I got a sergeant from the Eastern Front. He was in the VKM, and he was a specialist in catching mice. By just taking his arm down to the floor, and the mice jumped into his sleeve, like a lightning, he took his other hand and he caught the mice going in there and left their little head.
Well, that's the same story that Dr. Sulin has told me. He lived on mice for a long time in Russia during the sound campaign. That was the only food they had. Nice fresh mouse, and that would last another day.
But we built our camp up there again, our facility, and started to test again there for the A4, or V2 as it was called later, and for the butterfly nest. Finally, during that time, my family arrived in from Eastern Russia in Friedland, and I guess it more detailed. I mean, my whole family, yeah. My wife arrived, it means I had a big family one day.
And they all live.
Five women. Four women. My three sisters-in-law, two sisters-in-law, my mother-in-law.
They all
came from Eastern Russia.
This is because of the advance of the
Yeah.
But they all came from because of the advance of Russian army. They
arrived in Friedland on the 27th of January.
Well, we're now in 45.
And somewhere in the beginning of February, 1945, we received the order to move our whole laboratory westward to a place unknown to us at that time. So we boarded two trains with big guns.
Flatten, 88 millimeter
flat. Yeah. And we moved through on the train, sold families and equipment to Magdeburg, where we were bombarded 3 times at night on a railroad station without any damage to us, except my boy lost his shoes in a mud hole. Where we jumped in. And from there we went to Jena, to Turingia.
Okay.
To Jena, which was just bombarded 2 nights before as a chemical plant. And we arrived in Leutenberg.
That was your destination?
Right, that's where we went.
He invited him to come to Cape Kennedy, and he attended the launch. He also worked in Huntsville, Alabama for a while after the war. I persuaded the army at that time to invite him to come over for a number of years, and he actually stayed there until he retired.
Was there one...
Was there a common denominator in the motivation of the three men, Falkowski, Goddard, and Obert, as they proposed to develop a space flying capability? Well, I do not know, but I strongly suspect that all three were fundamentally motivated by the words of Falkowski, one of the three, who said, the Earth may be man's cradle, but who wants to stay in the cradle forever? I think the desire to fly through outer space was probably as fundamental with these men as the desire to fly like a bird does for the early aviation pioneers. They didn't look for immediate utility. They found something very fundamental and very natural in man's desire to extend his sphere of activity, almost a basic natural urge, like the urge of living beings that grew up in the oceans to crawl on land and try to find a new existence on dry land. I think they must have felt that this was something very basic in the mental makeup of man, and man, now that he obviously had a capability to do these things at a fingertip, that he would be betraying his very mission on Earth if he wasn't responding to this challenge.
Can you tell me of an event that you consider to be of major significance in the history of rocketry in which you were involved?
Well, there were a number of them, of course. Rocket about 6 foot tall and 1 foot in diameter that climbs an altitude of not quite 2 miles. These things I had virtually designed and built myself with the help of one mechanic. They both flew very successfully. Another very major milestone in my own life was probably the first successful flight of a V-2 rocket in October 1942. This was a successful flight after quite a number of partial failures, and this flight proved what in those days was doubted by quite a few people, whether you could build, for instance, a sphere rocket that could pass through the sonic barrier, go into supersonic speed, and continue flying under control of a gyroscopic and inertial guidance system. Well, other incidents were the launching of Explorer-1, the United States first satellite. This launching utilized a Redstone rocket, which we had developed when I was working for the United States Army, which we modified for the specific purpose of giving us a satellite orbiting capability. This launching took place in 1958. Then, of course, there was the first Saturn V launching, and more recently, of course, the lunar landing of the Apollo 11 crew.
How the rocket program evolved in Germany during the war? For mentioning the rocket society and so forth, that it gives us a brief picture of
chronologically, the development of rocketry in Germany went something like this. There was a period in 1928-29, 1930, where rocketry was really in the headlines in Germany. There was, for example, a man who stuck rockets into an automobile and demonstrated rocket-powered cars on a racetrack. Shortly thereafter, somebody else stuck solid rockets into a glider airplane and performed the first rocket flight. It was at that time also that a major motion picture company in Germany made a picture of a flight to the moon, and they enlisted my mentor and teacher, Professor Hermann Obert, as the scientific consultant for that picture. And it was virtually through the resources provided by this motion picture producer that the first serious rocket test with liquid-propelled rockets got underway in Germany. The German Society of Wissenschaften, of which I was a member since 1927, then organized a base on which systematic rocket research was conducted in the outskirts of Berlin. This base was called Rocketing Berlin, and I worked there for about a year. It was only a demonstration of a successful rocket glider, it was a half-successful rocket glider. The German army became interested, and we were trying to solicit their funds. Just like the early aviation pioneers in this country, including the Wright brothers, by the way, got their funds from the United States Army. It seems to be the only way to get going in this world. And in this fashion, I became ultimately a civilian service employee of the German Army. They gave me research grant in 1932 to do a doctor thesis on liquid-fueled rocket engines, and after I got my PhD on the thesis, they hired me. The army insisted on complete secrecy, and so from then on, all my work was behind the barbed wire fence of an army base, first at the the revolving ground in Gummersdorf near Berlin and effective 1937 after the German Army and the German Air Force got together and decided there was really a great potential in rocketry at a joint Army and Air Force moving ground at Peenemünde on the Baltic Sea. I became the technical director of this of the Army element of Peenemünde and served there until the end of the war, and it was at that region where the V-2 rocket was developed. Later on also an anti-aircraft rocket by the name of Wasserfall that became a kind of a set the piece for all kinds of anti-aircraft guided missiles that were later on developed in this country.
Yeah, and Don Tolstoy apparently took a liking in our group and was convinced that we could make a contribution in America and would maybe in due time become good Americans. And so he invited us to come to America, and of course we came over on the temporary contract, and the contract was extended a few times. And well, finally, we became employees and were offered and received American citizenship and so forth. And, then, of course, much later, our particular segment in the United States Army that worked on guided missiles became an element of NASA.
Where'd they go?
I first went to the White Sands Moving Ground in New Mexico, where V-2 evaluation flights were conducted. Approximately 100 V-2 rockets manufactured in Germany and in various states of completion as far as assembly was concerned were shipped to this country, and the idea was to try them out, make the flight evaluation. And my first activity was to act as a consultant for the preparation of these birds, which after all we had designed and which could not be launched without some degree of know-how. That was my first activity, and then very soon these V2s became very popular with some scientists who wanted to carry high-altitude research instrumentation into the stratosphere and beyond the outer space, and so we provided transportation for them for high-altitude. And then, of course, in due time, the Army said, well, now we know enough about the V-2, let's go on and design some more advanced vehicle. And that went on for a number of years. Out of all this, as I say, we finally wound up in NASA.
Dr. Goddard also worked at White Sands.
No, that's not correct. He worked in New Mexico, but about New Mexico is a pretty big state. He worked in the vicinity of Roswell, New Mexico. The background here was the following. He did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.